Talk given Saturday, 19th August, 1978. As you all know, the animal world consists of creatures who are creatures of feeling, almost entirely of feeling. What they receive in terms of stimuli and the way they respond or react is in terms of feelings. The vast majority of us mortals, whose bodies are of animal descent, are also creatures of feeling. In addition to feeling, during the 3 or 4 million years of our development, or whatever the time span may have been, there has emerged the process we call thought. And thought, as we know it and understand it, is simply talking. Some of us may say that I don't think in terms of words. And they proceed to say, I think in pictures or symbols of some sort or other. But the moment that person begins to look into the meaning of his pictures or his symbols, he will find that he cannot avoid talking, especially if he wishes to communicate that meaning to his fellow human beings. To communicate that meaning in more or less accurate and intelligible terms. If he were to say, no, I communicate with my fellow human beings also by drawing a picture or singing a song without words or whatever it may be, you will find that it is an imperfect communication in the first instance, and in the second instance, each person, the communicator and the communicatee, actually has usually quite a different interpretation of what is attempted to be communicated. So you cannot escape words. Language is fundamentally important for our human existence. And that has been added on to our life in terms of feelings. And if you look sufficiently deeply, sufficiently clearly, into this thought process, you will see, we will all see, that what we call our thinking is very heavily conditioned by our feeling. Whether that feeling be rational or irrational makes no difference to the fact that the thought process associated with that feeling is derived from that feeling. Feelings are the parent, so to say, of thought. And our feelings are almost entirely reactions, not true responses. In the case of us human beings, in the case of the animals of the animal world, barring the human world, in the case of the animal world, the whole process is considerably automatic. Stimulus, reaction. Stimulus, reaction. In us, our reactions in terms of thought in relation to these feelings are dominated by our conditioning from birth onwards. The same sort of sensation may find a reaction from one person in this or that manner. The reaction from another person may be quite similar, or it could be slightly different, or very different, and perhaps sometimes the very opposite. To take a common garden example, in a group of four or five people, somebody may say something, and two people afterwards talking about it, about what was said, may be in complete disagreement as to what that person meant by saying that. When the first person said it, certain feelings were aroused in the other person's present. And those feelings were interpreted, the reaction was interpreted in quite different ways. The thought vessel, shall I say, or the thought formulation related to the feeling had no, the two thought presentations had no relationship to each other. They were opposites. Now this we experience in our own lives, don't we? So we must recognize the fact that we are essentially still, despite all our education and so-called development and so forth, we are still creatures of feeling. Now, the question arises, what do we do about these feelings? Do we abide by them as true facts? Do we ignore them? Do we discard them? Do we struggle against them? Or do we try to enhance them? What do we do with regard to these feelings? If we are seriously concerned, truly concerned with living the religious life, meaning the life whose culmination is the complete flowering of full humanity in us, if that is our true concern, then we shall try to learn from each and every feeling that we register. This is the important thing. The path of the religious, of the yogi, is a path of discipleship. The disciple is the learner, discipulus. Disciple, the learner. And one may ask, well, who is our teacher? Our total life is our teacher. Everything that happens, every situation, everything that we read, everything that we hear, speak about, all that is our teacher. If we appreciate, really appreciate the fact that if we are truly concerned with the religious life, we are disciples, we are learners. And our business is to learn from each and every single experience through every moment of the day. No holidays, I'm afraid, where such learning is concerned. It's perpetual schoolwork and homework. But if we are truly sincere about this, we shall wake up to and experience the true zest of living. Because if we cease to learn, we might as well be dead. We have already fossilized inside ourselves. We don't learn anymore. All growth of any sort is a process of learning. The growth of the body itself, from the time we are born onwards, is a process of learning by the body. And through the body, how to be at home within the body, how to accept the body as such, how to appreciate its real value, its real meaning and significance and purpose in life, and so forth. So the very process of bodily growth alone, which is the root of our existence in the world, is a school of learning. And it might not be far from the truth. In fact, it might be very near the truth to say that one's own living body and the living processes which go on continuously all through our lives are some of the most important sources from which we learn our fundamental lessons. What do we human beings ordinarily do, though? We take the body for granted. Don't we? And because we take the body for granted, we naturally do not give it its proper due. What happens? The body on its own reacts back against us. There is, on the one hand, our self-consciousness, which is largely a brain consciousness, which is responsible for this idea and awareness of oneself in terms of I am I as an entity. this I neglects the body. But the body, consisting of 15 billion cells, each of which has the capacity to learn, and in that sense, and to that degree, it has mind, this body kicks back at us. If we do not treat it with full respect, with understanding, with skill, with love, with reverence. We talk a lot about reverence for life. But we'd have to light a million candles, not just one, and try to find the person who really is one who reverences life. We have to start with this sort of understanding of the body. Now, this body is the receptor, the apparatus, which is affected by the stimuli that come to it. This is the original source, the first source of our feelings and our reactions. The thought process is something secondary to that. It comes afterwards. It is not a natural growth, it is a cultural growth. You appreciate the difference between the two. One is just nature itself, life itself, in its totality, at work, the feeling part. You can't stop stimuli coming to you because you live in a universe where there is a constant output of stimuli of all sorts. So you can't stop that. And you can't stop the body, because it has a nervous system and a brain, from experiencing the sensations which we call our feelings. At the physical level, they are just sensations, we call them feelings, and then the brain gets to work on it and produces thought forms associated with these feelings. So now, we have to learn from our feelings. If we do not really understand, come to understand our feelings, then we shall never be able to have a true understanding of what we call our ethical and spiritual values. So long as our ethical and spiritual values are merely impositions in terms of verbal formulations of certain ideas of ought to be's, this ought to be that and that ought to be that, then those values are not potent within us. They are just a heap of words. What gives them dynamic energy is our own psychical energy, our own feeling nature, essentially. The thought process is essential for giving structure to the functional process of feeling. So there we see what is perhaps the real living relationship, the dual root, so to say, of our psychical growth and life. The feeling aspect is really the more important aspect, and then when the thought aspect is in harmony with that, because we begin to understand the way our feelings arise, what the feelings are in themselves, how they function, and how we respond to them. That is what we have to learn to do. How to respond and not merely react. Now, let us try and see what is the difference between this mere reaction and true response in the human sense, the really human sense. When I experience a sensation, the brain and the nervous system tells me that this is a pleasant sensation. Or it tells me this is an unpleasant sensation. Now this belongs to the sphere of bodily living to start with. Entirely to the sphere of bodily living. The body by itself, possessing its natural, pure body sense, will accept the pleasant sensation insofar as it is conducive to the healthy functioning of each and every cell in the body. It will respond, the body will respond unconsciously. It will respond to the unpleasant sensation by being on the alert against letting that unpleasant sensation become too powerful. That is, by its instinctive avoidance of that which is too painful, because that is destructive to health and perhaps to life itself. So the body takes this in its stride, the pleasure-pain mechanism which is ingrained in us. Do get this very, very clearly. Now, in us human mortals, there is a psychical counterpart to this purely bodily sensation. Because we regard ourselves as particular entities. That's why we speak, we think, we feel, and we act in terms of I am I. So, the I says, I like this. Pleasant sensation, I like it. And then there grows up attachment to what I like, and I want more of it. The psychical counterpart to the unpleasant sensation is, I don't like it. And I develop an aversion towards it. An aversion which all too often can be destructive. That is to say, I want to get rid of this, I want to destroy it if necessary, because I don't like it. And all this, both ways, in terms of attachment and aversion, becomes a fixation. Now, if we are to learn truly from our feelings, the whole ordinary process of living bodily in this physical world, we must remain alert, very observant of this attachment aversion conflict in the psyche. Both of them produce conflicts. Attachment to what we like, attachment to what we call the good things, the noble things, the fine things, they also cause conflict. Look at the extraordinary history of the world proving this. People say, oh, this is the good thing, the right thing, the noble thing, come on. And they fall into conflict with their neighbors who think differently or who do not agree with them, or worse still, as far as these people are concerned, who oppose them. How many wars have arisen that way? How much sheer destruction and misery in ordinary life? We say we take wars because they are dramatic incidents as such. But take our daily life, our intercourse with our neighbors. Think of it. Even with the good things. How much more so with what are commonly called the evil things, the bad things, the deliberately hurtful, malicious, slanderous, untruthful, unlawful, and so forth. Now, if we observe the play of our likes, dislikes, the attachment, the attachments, the aversions, and the fixations which therefore arise in the psyche, if we watch that very carefully, then in the act of watching, we shall learn the truth about ourselves through our feelings. Self-knowledge begins here. And that self-knowledge will inevitably get formulated in terms of ideas and words. We'll have patterns of words to express this knowledge of ourself. When we talk of somebody, we say, oh, he's a stern, harsh man. Or we say, he's a very considerate, understanding, gentle person, or something like that. Our knowledge, and the same applies to ourselves. We have our self-conceptions about ourselves. And as long as we function, the psyche, our own psyche functions ambivalently, that self-knowledge is always not true knowledge. It is in dualistic terms. It is in terms of that which gives rise to continuous conflict, which is against the trends of life, life in its wholeness, as it functions through us. But as we remain awake and alert, knowing that this is the kind of thing that happens, this is the difficulty to which we are all liable, we can gradually disentangle ourselves from taking sides with what is liked against that which is disliked. When we can keep the balance, therefore, within ourselves, our self-observation becomes truly fruitful. Otherwise not. Otherwise all our self-observation and so-called self-knowledge is tainted by our fixed ideas. And therefore does not reveal the truth about ourselves. But once we begin to be balanced inside ourselves, poised, well aware that, oh yes, here we are unbalanced. We are swayed this way or that way. We take sides with this against that. Once we really awake to that, then the limitations of our conditioning through both natural evolution and through socio-cultural influences, all that loses its power, the limitations associated with that. We can never escape conditioning as such. Conditioning, as long as there is a particular manifestation, something existing as such, a human being, see, that human being can never escape conditioning from the time it is born till the time it dies. There's no escape from that. But as and when we become aware of that conditioning, truly aware, truly perceiving all the limitations imposed upon us by that conditioning, and we observe how these limitations affect our observation throughout the living process, then those limitations no longer bind us, and there is freedom from our conditioning, as we ordinarily say. Which is not exactly a correct phrase. It's not sufficiently accurate. Certain essential conditioning will everlastingly be there throughout our life. Otherwise, particular existence cannot be there. You see? The finite, the mortal, of necessity has conditioning. If we understand this very clearly, we will see the folly of struggling against, fighting against this, that or the other. Why did such a perfected being as the founder of Christianity say, resist not evil? Nor did he say, take sides or make friends with the good. I, the particular entity, do not know evil in its full sense. I do not know the good in its full sense. But by being aware of all the limitations, and remaining poised and quiet in the midst of them, this person who is referred to by myself as I becomes free of the limitations imposed by all conditioning. This is the freedom which can be present in us. And in that state, one fights against nothing. One approves of, takes sides with nothing. What is the consequence? What happens then? The totality functions freely through the particular, the finite, and the mortal. The universe doesn't reject any part of itself, does it? It can't, for one thing. The universe as a whole, the one total reality, the alone, that means not the lonely, but the one only, is the one only. It is in our consciousness which functions in the way that it does because we are constituted as we are constituted. It is in our consciousness that the rift comes. And we say, good, evil. Get rid of this, cultivate that. It is as if you were Lord and each one of us was Lord and Master of an infinitely large garden, size of the whole universe. And we said, oh, I'll water this part and tend this part and neglect that part. Would I be a good gardener, a good Lord and Master of that garden? If we understand this, we would completely cease to say a few nonsensical things or ask a few nonsensical questions. Why does God, etc., etc.? Or why does not God, if He is the all-good, the all-perfect, not allow this, that, and the other? The total universe is the total universe. It is I who stick labels, good, bad. Those labels are legitimate and valid within all limited contexts in relationship to other contexts which manifest another part of the Lord God. Now, if we are true religious and truly care, we shall be able to become the absolute good, to be the absolute good without knowing it. The moment we know it and we say to ourselves, oh, I have now become the good one, the holy one, I have ceased to be good and holy. Because whatsoever a person says about himself, that I am or have or attained or achieved, implies the consciousness of himself, the subject, as separate from his environment. But the environment was there before I was born, as far as the earth is concerned, for about 5,000 million years, and will continue to exist, possibly 5 or 15,000 million years, when this thing is dead. This wonderful I is a miserable little object, a humorously contemptible little object. We pride ourselves on our sense of humor. I think God's sense of humor is the only real sense of humor. You see, it is like that. You are that which is the totality. And the totality functions in its own unique, wonderful way through each one of us. Otherwise, our significance as individuals and the fulfillment of our individual purpose within the framework of the great purpose for all mankind would never come into being. There would be no fructification for the individual. These are not easy things truly to appreciate. Of course, as educated people, we understand the words. If what has been presented is a logical structure, the brain will say, oh yes, that's all right, that seems perfectly true. But you see, what the top layer of the brain cells do is only a fraction of what the whole being does. The consciousness of a single being is something immensely greater than what he is actually aware of in his waking state. Each cell, each single atom, each single subatomic particle is conscious. Of course, this is an arbitrary statement. It cannot be, I cannot prove it. I can only make it. I can only assert it. And any philosopher, any logician, any person who prides himself on being a hard-headed, practical, sensible fellow, he can dispute it with me and say, Firoz is talking nonsense. Well, all right. So be it. Let him say what he pleases. But consider this carefully. See, one of the fundamental meanings of consciousness is involved in this. What is it that enables the atom to fulfill its atomic functions? What is it that enables the molecule, a collection of atoms, a substance, a plant, a tree, an animal, a human being, to fulfill its functions? This is a power, an energy, which we may just as well call consciousness as call it God or Brahman or any other word we like. Because this coming to fruition, which displays pattern, shape, form, order, method, and all the rest of it, is characteristic of the functioning of consciousness through this living body. The moment this body dies, this person as such cannot display any of those qualities anymore. Consciousness has disappeared. Even without dying, if he is in the completely unconscious state, he cannot, of his own activity from within himself, display these qualities. Now, all this, I have said, in relationship to what we have considered in our previous two meetings. Total commitment marks the life of the truly religious person. Total commitment to growing in harmony with the trends of life for the human kingdom as such. And this total commitment cannot be just a case of thinking it or willing it. It cannot be a case even only of feeling it, however intensely. When all these aspects of ourselves are in real harmony, really gathered together in intensity, then it is in terms of being total commitment, being the total commitment, which gets manifested. And in that state, there emerges and freely, and there is free functioning of what we call compassion or love. And you'll see straight away how the ethical values, ethical and spiritual values, emerge from this root thing, compassion, love. Or to put it in abstract philosophical terms, this creative action in eternity by and through the primordial creative energy. And this is God or Brahman or whatever word you like, realizing itself, the infinite, the immeasurable, the immortal, realizing itself through each one of us individuals, who is the finite, the measurable, the mortal. And this means the fruition of man as man, in the full meaning of the word man. So, we have a lot to deal with. Learn from our feelings.